This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. The transgender community has received greater visibility in pop culture with stories like Laverne Cox and Caitlyn Jenner in recent years. And in North Carolina, the Charlotte City Council recently passed an ordinance to include non-discrimination protections for LGBT individuals. But despite the progress, 2015 also saw a record number of murders of transgender people, specifically women of color. Sarah McBride is the campaigns and communications manager at the Center for American Progress, and she advocates for transgender equality. She's a transgender woman, and her story reached national headlines when she came out while serving as American University student body president. She's passionate about her work, not just because she's a transgender person, but also because she married a transgender man. Her husband, Andy, died of cancer 4 days after their marriage, and their love story went viral. Sarah is going to give a talk called Moving Past the Transgender Tipping Point. That talk is today at UNC Chapel Hill. We have details at our website. But first, let me welcome Sarah McBride. So good to have you on the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
As I mentioned in the intro, let's start with Charlotte. Charlotte recently passed a non-discrimination ordinance. Several other cities and a couple of states have done the same thing. But one of the things you can't get past in these discussions is this question over public bathrooms that seems to disturb people on the conservative end of the spectrum.
Well, that's true. And I think it's important to know that despite our progress on LGBT rights over the last several years, the reality is that in most of this country, LGBT people still lack explicit protections from discrimination, which means that, for instance, a same-sex couple can be married on Sunday and still be at risk of being fired from a job, denied housing, or kicked out of a restaurant on Monday. And that's what the Charlotte ordinance tries to get at. It's one of now roughly 200 cities and counties that have passed such an ordinance, one of about 19 states that have passed such an ordinance. And as you said, the reality in these debates is that they also oftentimes devolve into conversations around bathrooms. And it's certainly an important conversation to have. Conservatives that oppose these laws are oftentimes concerned about transgender people like me using restrooms in accordance with our gender identity. But the reality is that if you can't use the right restroom, if you can't use a restroom in accordance with your gender identity, then you can't fully participate in public life. If you can't use a restroom at work, if you can't use a restroom at school, if you can't use a restroom at the movie theater, then you don't have equal access to our society. And so, you know, while some resort to fear-mongering and scare tactics, at the end of the day, bathroom access is incredibly important, not just for transgender people, but for everyone.
Well, so what is the net effect? Do you think that in some ways resorting to these last-ditch arguments and fears, is it a sign that there's actual progress being made?
I think it's certainly a reflection of the fact that society has moved very quickly towards LGBT equality, towards transgender equality. But the bathroom argument is something that we've heard in previous conversations around non-discrimination protections, not just for the trans community, but 20 or 30 years ago, it was about bathroom access for gay and lesbian people. Prior to that, it was about, obviously, bathroom access for people with disabilities and whether the Americans with Disabilities Act would ensure that people with disabilities had access, equal access to restrooms. Prior to that, it was a conversation in the civil rights movement. And so it's the same people resorting to the same tactics that they have in the past. I think those tactics were losing back then, and I think they'll continue to lose in this fight.
It seems to me, though, that it does get at the actual challenge of a shift in consciousness that's required to get us where we need to be in terms of our openness to all of the brothers and sisters who share our nation. And that is these are intimate moments. These are intimate
right.
places. And so we're talking about identity. These are some visceral fears.
Right.
It's not rational. It's beyond rational.
Right.
How do we approach it? How do you make the discussion when really we're at some of the deepest levels of the subconscious?
Well, and I think that's a really good point. And the fact is that bathrooms are a vulnerable place for everyone, right? You can't get much deeper and more emotional than that. And for transgender people, they are just as concerned about safety and comfort in a bathroom as people who aren't transgender. And these laws don't change anything. Transgender people are already using bathrooms in accordance with their gender identity. It just ensures that transgender people aren't harassed or discriminated against. But the question about bathrooms is a question that is much broader than just do we access restrooms and locker rooms. It's a question of whether we as a society affirm transgender people's gender identities. It's a question of whether we as a society can acknowledge that I, as Sarah McBride, am the woman that I know I am, or that my husband, Andrew Cray, was the man that he knew he was. And I think the reason why these scare tactics and the fear-mongering have been able to sort of take hold is because while we're talking about transgender people in a way that we haven't before, we still have an empathy gap in this country when it comes to the non-transgender population understanding and relating to transgender people and their experiences. And so I think moving forward, if 2015 was the transgender tipping point, which is what Time magazine called it, then this year I think has to be the year where we as a country move past the headlines and get into a deeper understanding about what it means to be transgender, what it's like to be transgender, and what we have to do as a society to include all of God's children in our society.
And these questions were very personal for you, and you yourself had to come through a process to come to terms with who you are. Tell us about you considering coming out. You're president at the time. You were president of the student body at American University and hadn't come out yet. Talk about the thought process that went on.
Sure. It was obviously the hardest decision that I've ever had to make. I have known that I'm transgender my entire life. My earliest memories are of praying that I would wake up the next day and be who I am, of throwing pennies into fountains, blowing out birthday candles, and just wishing that I would wake up the next day and have society see me as I knew I was. And so for the longest time, I kept that inside. I told myself that if I could make it worthwhile by succeeding and making my family proud and maybe making a difference in the world, that those things would make it worthwhile for me to stay in the closet. But at the end of the day, I was serving as student body president, and the things that I thought would fill the void in my life, that would sort of solve the pain that I was in, didn't end up doing that. And it was my experience as student body president at American University that I think really reinforced for me the fact that I needed to take my life into my own hands and I needed to come out.
Did being student body president make it easier or more difficult for you?
I think that's a really good question. I think there are unique challenges, unique issues that a person has to face when they come out in a slightly more public way. But I think for me, overall, it was a privilege to be able to come out in a more public fashion for a number of reasons. One, it was an opportunity to educate people. It was an opportunity to educate my campus community about transgender people and transgender issues. It was an opportunity, I think, to get my story out in my own words. Because when I would walk down the campus quad, I would see people snickering at a transgender student. Fortunately, I never had to experience that. And I think part of that was because when I came out, people felt like they already knew me. People felt like they understood my story. And I think it's very difficult to hate people whose story you know.
So did you see yourself going into LGBT advocacy right out of college?
I didn't. I had always dreamed that I'd go back to my home state of Delaware to work in politics or in government. But when I graduated, I was faced with a decision that's very common for LGBT people, and that's the decision between going home to the place you love or being safe and secure, because Delaware had no statewide law against discrimination for transgender people. And so as I graduated, I went back to Delaware and worked with my parents, Equality Delaware, and people from across the state to pass a non-discrimination bill. And I think it was the experiences pushing for that bill that demonstrated the need for that type of legislation, not just in Delaware, but in cities and states across the country, and of course federally, now with this new Equality Act, which is a comprehensive non-discrimination bill.
So you decided to do that. And tell us then about meeting your husband, Andy.
Yeah. So I was fortunate enough to gain an internship at the White House during my senior year after coming out as transgender. And it was there that I met my future husband, Andy. He was, as you mentioned, a transgender man who came out in college. He was a bit older than I am, 3 or 4 years older than I am. He came out in college, transitioned in college, and was fighting for LGBT equality in D.C., and we fell in love. A couple months after we started dating, he was diagnosed with cancer. And after a really incredible, courageous, selfless battle with cancer, he initially got a clean bill of health, but a few months later, his cancer came back. And it was, we quickly learned that it was a terminal situation. And when he found out it was terminal, he asked me if I'd be willing to marry him. and our friends, including Bishop Gene Robinson, who's an incredible openly gay bishop in the Episcopal Church, helped put together a wedding for us in about a week. And we married on a Sunday, and Andy passed away on a Thursday, the Thursday after our wedding. And I think for me, that experience demonstrated the urgency of this movement and this cause, which is that every day matters. When you're fighting for a cause to allow people to live their life to the fullest, you can't waste a day. Andy had only a quarter of his life as his authentic self. He had the courage to come out in college. He should have had three quarters of his life. But unfortunately, because of circumstances out of his control, that was cut short. And a lot of people have even less time. And so it really, I think, reinforced the need that even though we're moving quickly as a country, even though people, I think, outside of the LGBT community sort of have a bit of whiplash from this quick change, at the end of the day, we can't move fast enough when lives are at stake.
Well, I think it points to something else obliquely in the sense that you told your story publicly and that story went viral, again, because of it. It's a compelling story in and of itself. So you have two opportunities here to go public and be supported in who you are and what you did. But a lot of people don't. They're not student body president, and they don't have such a compelling story to tell. And those are the stories that are left in the shadows and people with a lot more difficulty coming out, becoming their authentic selves.
That's very true. And I have been very fortunate in the support network that I have, in the friends and family that I have, in the economic opportunities that I've been given. But for transgender people across this country, that's not a uniform reality. Poverty is particularly high in the trans community. Roughly a 1/4 of transgender people report being fired from their jobs simply because of who they are. I mean, that's a huge number when you think about it. And so we have a lot more work to do. You know, we have the stories of Caitlyn Jenner. We have Laverne Cox, who has achieved incredible and inspirational success in the entertainment field. But we still have so much work because so many people are still living in poverty, still facing discrimination. As you mentioned at the start, too many are still dying simply because they've chosen to live their life in an authentic and complete way.
So you're giving a talk at UNC. It's called Moving Past the Transgender Tipping Point. I suspect we've heard some of the talking points, but if you can give us more of a preview, what you're going to say.
Yeah, well, I think, like I said at the start, this is a really monumental time for the transgender community. And we are facing unprecedented attention, visibility. But I think that we need to really bridge the empathy divide that currently exists in this country. I think part of that is through telling stories, and I'm looking forward to telling the folks tonight a little bit more about my own personal story, but also talking about the work that continues and how allies in this effort are going to be incredibly important in securing transgender rights. Only about 16% of the U.S. population say they know someone who's transgender. That's even less than people who say they've met someone or they've seen a ghost. And so we have our work cut out for us. And it is through telling stories. It is through bridging that empathy guide. But we need our allies to help amplify those stories. We need allies to model the type of behavior that is affirming and loving of transgender people. And those are just some of the points that I'm looking forward to talking about tonight.
Tell us about those alliances and those allies. Have those alliances been growing? And I'm thinking particularly of churches in this regard. How are those connections going these days?
Yeah, I think they're growing. I think one of the situations we find ourselves in right now is that the non-LGBT population that has been so supportive on issues of marriage is now beginning to realize that sort of transgender equality is the next issue. It's the next point where they're going to be standing up for equality. And so I think that we've seen an increase in the number of allies, non-LGBT allies, stepping forward, saying that transgender people are worthy of dignity and respect. We've seen it from presidential candidates. We've seen it from elected officials. We've seen it from more and more progressive and grassroots organizations. And frankly, we've seen it from more churches. I was really excited to join with Bishop Gene Robinson, the gentleman who married Andy and I, a year and a half ago, to release a trans-inclusive faith theology for churches to be able to embrace their transgender people in a way that conforms and reinforces their faith. And we're seeing that across the country. I know for my family, our church was incredibly important in my coming out process. It was incredibly affirming. And I don't know what it would have been like if that wasn't the case. And one of the things we tried to do with this trans-inclusive faith theology was to not only provide a resource to churches and faith leaders, but to provide a resource to people who are struggling with their own identity, who've grown up with religion as the framework with which they view and live in society, and giving them sort of a path forward
To remain committed to their faith.
To remain committed to their faith in a way that also allows them to be committed to their authenticity.
And what about the progress that's been made in terms of gay rights very quickly over the past few years? Are you heartened by that? And is there a kind of transferability? Do you see that sort of as the transgender issues being a part of that, taking benefiting by that momentum?
Yeah, I think that we have experienced an unbelievable amount of progress on gay rights in particular over the last several years. And it's incredibly inspiring, not just for the trans community, but I think for our country to be able to witness and experience that rapid change. And I do think that it has provided the public with a foundation to more readily embrace and accept transgender people. We've talked about how the LGBT community, throughout the fight for marriage equality, we've also been talking about the LGBT community. And I think it's important right now to finally move past having just the T as a throwaway conclusion to that acronym, and to finally bring it up to par and parity with the gay rights movement. And I think we're starting to see that, but it's definitely transferable. I think there's some unique challenges and some unique components, but at the end of the day, it's about embracing and loving and including all people.
Sarah, what a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Sarah McBride, Campaigns and Communications Manager for the Center for American Progress. She's going to give a talk called Moving Past the Transgender Tipping Point. That's today at 5:30 at UNC Chapel Hill's Hyde Hall in the Institute for Arts and Humanities. And if you missed it, you can go to our website, stateofthings.org. We've got it all there. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Will Michaels, Charlie Shelton, Ormond, and Andrew Tai. Robin Copley is our technical director. Brent Wolf, WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.